Well, amen. Well, this is good news, bad news for me. Occasionally I get in churches that, you know, when the end of the week comes, I don't want to go home. And this is one of those weeks. I have fallen in love with you, as hopefully you have with me. I pray that we will have days in the future together. I will pray for you. In a new way now. I won't be driving by asking, when do I get to come back? I'll be driving by remembering our time together. And so I want to take a minute before I get to the word tonight to just say, on behalf of Harry, Lynette, and Andrew Layden, we want to thank you for the investment you will make into our life this week. I never talk about the love offering until after it's all over. I want you to know that your giving this week has made it possible not only for my family and I to live, but you've made it possible for us to do a ministry that God has called us to do. When I get home tomorrow, I have five couples that are waiting to see me when I get in. I'm driving all night, or not all night, I'll drive 4 hours after leaving tonight. I get in about 1:30, and I have a 10 o'clock appointment, a noon appointment, a 1, a 3, and a 5, and these couples will come in. We don't charge them a dime. We don't plan to charge them a dime. We believe that God can provide our needs, and He's going to use people like you to do that. You've made investments this week financially that make it possible for my family and I to do a ministry. We have no salary that comes in. We have no sugar daddies that pump big bucks into our ministry. I want you to know we simply walk with God by faith and we take Him at His word. You've made that possible this week. And I know that you all have given graciously, and I appreciate, and I have no idea what it is, but I appreciate all that you have done. I want you to know that in the rest of this year, we have five more meetings. Two of those meetings will be at churches that run 100. Your giving this week allows us never to say no when smaller churches call and say, can you come? And the answer is, whoever calls first gets those dates. I've never canceled a church because a bigger church has ever called me. That's just not our style. And so I, from the bottom of my heart and from my family, want to say thank you for your generosity, your hospitality, and for all that you have done this week to invest in us as we have come to invest in you. Now, I talked with Lynette today. She wanted to know how everything was going. She said to make sure I said goodbye to y'all and that she loves you and that she wished she could be here, but that she was doing what she needed to do. And then she asked me, she said, have you sold very many tapes? And I said, well, a few. And she goes, well, they always wait till Wednesday anyways. And she said, maybe tonight, if they were to buy a few tapes, you know, there's a couples tape down there, and there's Sunday mornings, chickens, quitters, and pigs tape, and then there's the dinners down there, and then there's a couple other tapes. And she said, Harry, maybe if they were to buy some of those tapes, would it be okay if we took that money tonight and bought some food? So y'all just... You do what God leads you, you know. I must confess to you a sin, though, before I leave here, that God has shown me, that I was not a gracious winner like normally last night, and so God had to correct me, and there was no worse way than to let a minister of music beat you in golf. And so I have repented, and we played 9 more holes after that, and I beat him like a bad stepchild again. And so where I come from, whoever won last was the winner. And so we'll just leave it at that. Take your Bibles tonight and turn with me to Judges chapter 6. You say, how can we keep in touch with you? You know, there's a lot of guys that will put a big mailing list out there and then they'll send you their envelope every month. We don't do that. We send out a newsletter about twice a year to let you know what's going on. And if you would like to get on that newsletter, I make it very difficult for you to do that. If you would like to get on my newsletter where you receive a letter from us and you want to know how we're doing, you may email me at hl33@AOL. Give me your name and address, and there I'll put you on our newsletter. I don't have any sign-up sheets. If you really want to be a part of knowing what's going on in our ministry, I'll let you do that, but I make it hard. You got to really want to. So HL33@AOL, you will not get any envelopes, you will not get anything except us talking about what God is doing and how to pray for us. We'll never ask you for money, it's just not our style. And so we'd ask you as we leave that you would finally pray for us. I'll be at a, ready for this? I will be at a Free Will Baptist Church starting Friday night. We're doing a couples weekend. And they've got about 30 couples coming through the weekend. It's in Tulsa. And this pastor is just juiced up. And he said, you know, the only thing I ask you is you don't preach on security of the believer. And I said, well, the only thing I ask is why I'm here, you don't try to wash my feet. And we'll be fine. Judges chapter 6. Again, the Israelites did evil in the eyes of the Lord, and for 7 years he gave them into the hands of the Midianites. And because the power of Midian was so oppressive, the Israelites prepared shelters for themselves in the mountain clefts, caves, and strongholds. Whenever the Israelites planted their crops, the Midianites, Amalekites, and other eastern people invaded the country, and they camped on the land and ruined the crops all the way to Gaza, and did not spare a living thing for Israel, neither sheep, nor cattle, nor donkey. They came up with their livestock and their tents like swarms of locusts. It was impossible to count the men and their camels. They invaded the land to ravage it. Midian so impoverished the Israelites that they cried out to the Lord for help. When the Israelites cried to the Lord because of Midian, he sent them a prophet who said, "This is what the Lord, the God of Israel, says. I brought you up out of Egypt, out of the land of slavery. I snatched you from the power of Egypt and from the hand of your oppressors. I drove them out before you, and I gave you the land." So what he's saying is, I'm the one who has delivered you. I am the one who has done this. I have done everything. Everything you have as a church, First Baptist Church Altus, you have because God has delivered you. And he said unto them, "I am the Lord your God. Do not worship the gods of the Amorites, Altusites, Tulsaites, whose land you live, but you have not listened to me." So for 7 years they're facing adversity. Now adversity comes, I believe, for one of two reasons. Number one, it comes for correction. It comes for correction. When you're out of sorts with God, because you're His children, He's gonna spank your bottom. It also comes, number two, for enlargement. We saw it last night with the spiritual scars. It teaches me how to be dependent on God. It teaches me how to walk in Christ's likeness. It teaches me how to walk with God by faith. And without faith, it is impossible to please God. You cannot please Him except through the walk of faith. Now, He's correcting Israel here. And the Bible goes on to say, "And the angel came and sat down under the oak of Ophrah that belonged to Joash the Abizite, where his son Gibeon was threshing wheat in the winepress to keep it from the Midianites. When the angel of the Lord appeared to Gideon, he said, 'The Lord is with you, mighty warrior.'" The Lord is with you, mighty warrior. Now let me explain to you what that means. That is equivalent to God showing up here tonight and saying to me, "The Lord is with you, thin guy with a lot of hair." It's not quite true. Gideon was not yet a mighty warrior any more than you are the church God wants you to be. But God does not see you where you are. He sees you where you're going to be. And when he sees you where you're going to be, he looks at Gideon and he says, "The Lord is with you, mighty warrior." The Bible goes on to say this, "But sir," Gideon replied, "if the Lord is with us," and here's how we know he was a Baptist, "why all this happened to us?" Hey, if the Lord is with us, how come all this bad stuff's happening? Where are all the wonders that our fathers told us about? Did not the Lord bring us up out of Egypt? But now the Lord has abandoned us and put us into the hand of the Midianites. And the Lord turned. First the angel talks, now God's talking. And the Lord turned to him and said, "Go in the strength you have and save Israel out of Midian's hand. Am I not sending you?" "But Lord," Gideon asked, "how can I save Israel? My clan is the weakest in Manasseh. I'm the least in my family." And the Lord answered, "I will be with you." Gideon did not see himself as hero material. He did not see himself as mighty warrior. Young people, if anything else, Gideon was hiding in the wine presses, and Gideon was not the mighty warrior that God said he was. And here was Gideon always coming to a place, and now the Midianites coming into the land, and they're taking everything. Back me off just a smidgen. They're taking everything. And for 7 years, Israel lay helpless. They're bleeding. They're hiding in caves. They're hiding in the strongholds, because Israel must learn a sad lesson, and the lesson is this: disobedience brings judgment. My friend, for the believer, we have taught you Christ-likeness this week, and I'm going to be real upfront and honest with you. I have watched the last couple of days, and you know what I'm seeing? I'm seeing a good portion of this church getting it. But I'm also seeing a portion of this church that's rearing up its ugly head, and it shows itself in, "You've hurt my feelings." It shows itself with, "Let me tell you what I think," or "I'm mad at you," or "I can't forgive you." And when you're talking like that, I want to tell you something. You are not broken, and disobedience is going to bring judgment. And I'm here to tell you something tonight. I've shared with you truth for 6 days. If you don't get it and apply it, God is going to bring judgment on you personally. Because you now have truth. I think corporately, you've gotten it. But I want you to know, I think individually, there's some of you who still don't get it. Life's about you and what you think, what you feel, and what you want, instead of what does God think and feel and want. And I want to tell you something, you better hear this. God will bring judgment on your disobedience, because now you know the truth. Are you getting that? Here's another thing. The greatest enemy of man is man. And the greatest enemy of self is self. If it wasn't for us, folks, we would not get in trouble. But aren't you glad that God gives grace to the humble? Aren't you glad that God's correction, when He does correct us, is just for a season? Aren't you glad that God does not give us what we deserve? Aren't you glad that there's mercy and grace available to you? But I had a guy that would come in for counseling, and I counseled he and his wife for over a year. I spent almost 60 hours with him, and he'd always come in, and he'd say, "Oh, I'm sorry, Brother Harry. I know I shouldn't have done that, but I went ahead and did it anyways. Oh, I'm sorry, Brother Harry. Oh, I'm sorry. I asked my wife to forgive me. I asked God to forgive me." And it got to the end of the counseling. You know what I said to him? "You can't come back." And he said, "Why?" I said, "Because you, my friend, are a grace abuser. You're a grace abuser. God gives you grace and you keep messing up, and then you come back with the, 'Oh, I'm so sorry, I'm so sorry, I'm so sorry.'" Listen, folks, God is going to correct grace abusers, because the greatest enemy of man is man. The greatest enemy of self is self. And God says, "I brought this correction on you because you're not listening to me." And there's still some of you in here tonight are not listening to God. And you're a whole bunch more Christ-like than I would have been if I'd got that letter. Especially after what's been being preached here. Because that's the act of a person who I know in their heart is hurting. And you know what? When you're hurting, you either run to God or you transfer blame to somebody else. So if you're here, I got a word for you. I know you're hurting, and you need to run to God, and you need to run to your pastor, because there's mercy and grace available to you, and there's a listening ear that will love you, and he told you that last night. And I appreciate last night, as you shared, that it was not to draw any attention to you, or to have everybody come bring you a card, or you know, pay your way through high school or something, you know. It was for simply coming to the place where people could stop and say, "Here's what God has to say. Here's what we have to do." Now, God is about to turn the adversity of Israel into opportunity. God, let me, you missed that. Let me say it again. God is about to turn adversity into opportunity. Now let me tell you where I'm going here tonight. I got a call, I guess it was about 4 years ago, from a church in Oklahoma City. Big church. And they said, "We want you to go on a mission trip with us." I said, "All right." Where? He said, we're going to Cambodia. Phnom Penh, Cambodia. I said, are you kidding me? People die in Cambodia. How come nobody goes on mission trips to Bermuda? What, no lost people in Bermuda? How come we always got to go to Africa? What's wrong with the Virgin Islands? No lost people in the Virgin Islands? Hawaii? No lost people in Hawaii? See, my goal is home missions. When I'm done preaching, I want to work with delinquent golf pros in Hawaii. Straighten them out. Lead them to the Lord. Spend time. Disciple them. It may take hours. And so I said to him, I said, people die in Cambodia. He goes, not only do they die, you can't be on the streets after 9 o'clock because you carry more money in your wallet right now than most of those folks make in a year. And they'll just soon kill you to get that wallet. When the sun goes down, you got to be off the streets. He goes, and that's not all. It's Cambodia. It's $2,500 and you got to pay your own way. Let me get this straight. You want me to go to some third world toilet where there's a chance I could die and I got to pay for it? So I gave him the Baptist answer, which is what? I'll pray about it. Which means what? I got no intention of going. But I don't want you to think I'm like super spiritual, so I'll pretend I'm spiritual here and say, well, let me bring this to God and I'll ask him. Not. When everybody ever tells you, let me pray about it, you know what that means? They got no intention of doing what you've asked them to do. And so I went to my wife and I said, oh, you're going to love this one. I've been invited to go to Cambodia. It's $2,500. She goes, people die there. I said, man, ain't that the truth? And she goes, I think you should go. Thanks. I said, why do you think I should go? She goes, because God hasn't stretched you in a long time. Don't you hate it when they're right? Are you that way too? You're always right. You guys are always right. She goes, God has not stretched you in a long time. He has not stretched your faith in a long time, Harry. And you know what? I think you should go. You need stretching. Well, I'll pray about it. Now, a couple days go by. I went into my pastor, and here's what I said to him. Pastor, you're going to love this one. And my pastor is a Bible teacher. So I called the guy back. I said, okay, what are we going to do in Cambodia? He said, you're going to teach the Bible to 25 Cambodian pastors, some of them driving 400 miles on moped bikes to get there. They're going to stay there for a week. They're going to sleep on the floor. We're going to feed them every day, and you're going to teach them the book of Acts is what we want you to teach. And we're going to teach them the book of Acts 8 hours a day for 7 days. And there was two other teachers. Doug Melton was going to teach in Rough and Snow, and I was going to be the third teacher. And so my answer was, I'm not a scholar. I'm not a scholar. And the guy looked at me and he goes, Harry, I don't know how to break this to you, but in Cambodia, even you are a scholar. So I went to my pastor. I said, we ought to switch. I should stay here and preach. You should go to Cambodia. You're the teacher. So I told him about it. And he goes, you going to go? I said, no, I don't have $2,500. I can't make that trip. I just don't have the money. He goes, well, we'll pay for it. Everybody's trying to bump me off. I said, what do you mean? He goes, go to the secretary. Tell her to give you a $3,000 check. Take the $2,500, go to Cambodia, and take the other $500 and use it at your discretion and give it away to the missionaries as you see fit. I said, well, let me pray about it. I get another call. Like 4 days after this, I get a call. A guy calls me. He goes, why don't you go on a mission trip with me? Where do you want to take me? He goes, we're going to Scotland for 14 days. I said, to do what? He goes, you're going to get to preach about 5 times, but I want you to come with me because I want you to train Scottish pastors how to share their faith. That's my wheelhouse. I know how to do that. And then while we're there, we're going to have 5 free days, and we're going to play the 5 greatest golf courses in Scotland, and I would like to pay for everything. Here am I, Lord. Send me. Ain't no praying about this one, is there? And he looks at me and he says, now I must share one little thing with you. There are 19 other pastors who are praying like crazy. You can't go. And I said, well, I can't go. And he said, you're kidding me. I said, no, I can't. He goes, why? Because I'll be in Cambodia. And he said, well, how do you know that? Well, I didn't until you offered me the counterfeit. See, whenever God has a will, church, there's always a counterfeit. Whenever God says Christ's likeness, there's always you in flesh telling you go this way. Whenever Christ moves in the church, there's always a Herb and a Herbette that will lift up their ugly head and pop off about what they think. And opinions are like belly buttons, folks. Everybody's got one. And when he invited me to go, I immediately saw the counterfeit compared to the will of God. And I said, okay. Now, it was going to be several months before we left. And in that period of time, I got another call. It was from my oldest brother, Richard. Now, let me tell you about my brother, Richie. When I tell you my dad died when I was 6, my brother was 11. And my aunts and uncles did something terrible to my brother when my daddy died. They walked up to him at 11 years old, put their hands on his shoulder and said, now you are the man of the house. And that was the worst thing they could have ever done to that boy, because he knew he could never perform well. Not only that, I was my mother's favorite. Well, duh. I'll give you a little hint. Of all my brothers and sisters, I'm the pick of the litter. What's that tell you? My brother Richard, I have a brother Tommy. Tommy's retarded. He's in a state mental hospital. And Tommy calls me all the time. He's right now in a nursing home because he has emphysema very bad. And he will call me and he goes, hey, this is Tommy. Can you send me some money? And so, you know, every month we send Tommy money. We send him his shoes. We send him his clothes that he needs. We take care of him because he's my brother. And my brother Richard, though, he was a tough kid, guys. My brother Richard was about 6 foot tall. He weighed 300 pounds. He drove and rode in motorcycle gangs. His name was Mao Tse-tung. And they shortened it to Mao Tse. And that's the reason they called him that, because my brother was a dictator. My brother was a tough kid. I want to tell you something. Growing up, I've been in 5 fights my whole life. I'm 2 and 3. You want to know why I've never been in any fights? Because if you hit me, you had to fight my brother. Now, my brother beat the peewadding out of me every day, but if you touched me, he would reach into your chest and rip your heart out and stick it down your throat. Nobody touched his brother. My brother was tough, tough kid. My brother had a date one night, and she broke the date. So he got on his motorcycle and he drove over where she was, young people, and waited around the corner, and she came out and got into some convertible with some guy and drove off. And they went to the drive-in movie. And to show you what my brother was like, he waited till it was dark, and then when it got dark, he jumped on the hood with his Jim Bowie knife and went, are you all having a good time in there? And of course, the police wanted to chat with him that night, and I can remember him hiding in the backyard. And the police finally caught him and took him down to jail and stood before a judge. And the judge looked at him and said, I'm sick and tired of seeing you down here, Layton. You got 2 years in prison or 2 years in the army. You pick. My brother goes, I'll take prison. And the judge got mad at him. He goes, you'll take the army. And he sentenced him to 2 years in the army. And, of course, my brother had no attorney, and so he went down and signed up. Thought he had to. Spent 2 years in the army. Richie was a tough kid. Richie, though, I want to tell you something. Every day when I'd come home from school, he and I would play wiffle ball in the backyard. He was the Red Sox. I was the Yankees. We'd play 50 games a year. I beat him 2 out of the 50, and the 2 times I beat him, he chased me around the yard with the wiffle ball bat, hitting me with it. He likes losing about you and I, Rod, about the same way we like losing at golf. He didn't like losing. We'd play football in the backyard. We'd play touch. Not him. He played tackle. My brother, there came a period of time after I became a Christian, my brother blew me off and said, I don't want to talk to you, I'm not interested, and he disappeared. He disappeared for 3 or 4 years. Nobody even knew where he was. Didn't come by the family, didn't come by and talk to us, didn't come by and see anybody. He just didn't want anything to do with anybody anymore. And then Andrew was born. And I have a sister who's 47, she's not married, she's a mortician. Not the kind of girl you want to date. You go out with her and she's like, you're a prospect. And so my brother realized that Andrew would probably be the only nephew he would ever have. And so he calls me one day out of the blue and he goes, hey, kid. I said, where have you surfaced? He said, you're like a submarine. You've been down for about 4 years. Where have you surfaced? He goes, I live on Cape Cod now. Drive a truck up here. I said, well, how are you doing? He goes, I'm doing great. I want to be an uncle. I said, all right. He goes, when are you coming home? I said, I'm coming home this summer. He says, all right, I'll meet you at Patty's. And we drove up to Connecticut. I was going to do some preaching up there. Andrew was about 4 years old by this time. And we come in, and here's Richie, big old guy. He's about 320 now, 340. He's a big, big guy. Had a big old fluffy beard, sitting in a chair. And Andrew walks in, and he goes, are you my Uncle Richie? And he goes, I am. He goes, let's hug. And he gives him a big old hug. And it was like, vroom, 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 vroom. That's it. It's over. What do you want, kid? It's all yours. And all of a sudden, Richie wanted to be an uncle. And then we'd come back, and Richie lived on Cape Cod. And Richie has been married 4 times. His third wife and his fourth wife are the same. And she, at one time, was married to my cousin. Oh, it gets better. His wife is a hostile atheist. There's two types. There's intellectual atheists. Ha, 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 ha. You're so silly to believe in God. Ha, ha. Not her. She was a hostile atheist. Don't talk to me about God. I don't want you to talk to me. I don't want you to ever say a word to me about God. No God, no God, no God. And I'm like, why are you getting so upset about this thing that doesn't exist? For something that doesn't exist, it sure has got you all bent out of shape. So she and I didn't have like a lot in common. And years went by, and of course Andrew got bigger. And finally one day, before I went to Cambodia, I got a call from Richard. He goes, hey, I need you to pray for me. All right, who is this really? And I said, okay. I said, what about? He goes, well, I hadn't been feeling very good and I'm having trouble swallowing. And they said I got something down here in my esophagus and they're going to do some testing and they're going to go in and open me up. And what, if it's there's a little mass down there and they're going to cut it out. And so talk to your God for me, will you? I said, okay, I will. And I began to pray and I said, God, do whatever it takes in my brother's life. Do whatever it takes. And that was on a Friday, and he went on Monday. And I got a call on Monday night from my sister, and then I called my brother the next day. And they opened him up, and when they did, they closed him in 20 minutes because the cancer was so bad, it was wrapped around the aorta artery and was enmeshed in the aorta artery. And they said, there is nothing we can do for you. No surgery, no radiation. You are so absolutely full of cancer that you've got 2, maybe 3 months to live, and you're going to die. And so I went to my pastor and I said, I have to have some time off. I'd already used my 15 weeks, and that's back when I was on staff at this church before we stepped out in faith this year to stand on our own. And he said, what's up? I said, my brother's not a Christian. He's got cancer. He's dying. I've got to fly home to Connecticut. He goes, go. He goes, you got money? And I said, well, I'll put it on my credit card. He goes, did I ask you if you owned a credit card? I said, no. I said, I asked you, do you have the money? And I said, no, but I'll put it on my credit card and God will take care of me. He always has. He goes, did I ask you whether God was sufficient to take care of you? And I said, no, you asked me if I had the money. The answer is, no, I don't. And he said, okay, use your church's credit card that I have. I had a church credit card. And put your flight on the credit card. Put your rental car on the credit card. And we will take care of this for you. See, that's how the body of Christ works. When one has a need, the rest of them step to the plate and meet that need. And so I flew home to Connecticut, flew into Hartford, rented a car, drove down to Waterbury, picked my sister up, made a 3.5-hour drive up to Cape Cod where my brother lived. I walked in the door, and I hadn't, from the time the surgery had gone by, almost 30 days had passed. And in 30 days, he went from 320 pounds to 210. And they were feeding him through a tube because he couldn't swallow. And I went in, and I said, hey, I'm going to get a hotel. Patty and I are going to get a hotel. I said, Patty's just going to stay here. Can you come with me? And he said, sure, I feel okay. So he got in the car with me, and we drove over to the hotel. And as we got over to the hotel, I checked in, came out, sat down, and I looked at him, and I said, I can get you out of this. And he smiled at me, and this is his term of endearment for me. He says, kid, I'm all ears. I'm all ears. I said, Rich, this cancer is a blessing. He said, how's it a blessing? I'm going to die. Harry, I got 3 months, maybe 2 months. I'm going to die. How's this a blessing? I said, two ways, Rich. Number one, you know when you're going to die. That's a tremendous advantage. You got 3 months to say goodbye. You got 3 months to get your stuff in order. If God was some cosmic killjoy, when you had a stroke out on the Mass Pike 2 years ago driving your tractor trailer rig, he could have killed you, Rich. But he's giving you 3 months to get your life right, get your life together. I said, the second reason it's a blessing is because you've never needed anybody in your life. And suddenly, you can't get out of a something, and you need God more than you've ever needed him in your life, Rich. There's no way out except through God. And then I began to share the gospel with him again as we sat in that car, Bob, and I shared with him what I told him. And he looked at me that night, and he said to me, he goes, Harry, you have told me this story 20 times in 20 years. And every time you tell me this story, I tell you I am not interested in your God. But you know something? Every time you would tell me that story and you'd walk away, in my mind and my heart, I'm thinking, you know what he's saying is reasonable. We're all sinners. That's reasonable. We don't have any hope. Well, that's reasonable. Jesus died on the cross. Well, we know that's reasonable. And he's the only way to get to heaven. Well, that's what he said. That's reasonable. You know, you've been telling me this story for 20 years. What you say is reasonable. But here's my question. Would he forgive me even now because I'm desperate? I said, Richie, he waits for you to be desperate so that you will need him now. He waits for you to be desperate. He said, kid, I sure like to be forgiven. And at 5:06, sitting in that car, my brother bowed his head and prayed and invited the Son of God to come live in his heart. And then he said this to me, hey, when we get back home, don't tell her. Let me tell her in my own way. She'll get mad because she don't believe like we believe. And we stayed a day, and then we drove back to Waterbury. I stayed a couple days, and then I flew home. When I got home, there was a computer at my house. My brother took money out of his savings account. We didn't own a computer. And he said, I bought a computer so Andrew could get online and type to me at night. And his name on the computer, what do they call that? Screen name. Was Calabash. Good night, Mrs. Calabash, wherever you are. Jimmy Durante. Calabash. And I'd see him online. I said, Andrew, Uncle Richie's online. He goes, oh, Daddy, type for me. Tell Uncle Richie I love him. Hey, Rich, Andrew said to tell you he loves you. And tell him I'm sorry he's dying of cancer, but if he didn't smoke, this wouldn't have happened. He said, and he goes, you're typing it. I'm not typing it. He's telling me what to type. And my son today probably will never smoke because he doesn't want to end up like his Uncle Richie. And then when I get home, we got the computer, and then I called him. I said, you doing okay? He goes, I'm fine. He goes, hey, where's my Bible? What Bible? He goes, the Bible you're supposed to buy me after I pray that prayer. Yeah, that Bible, yeah. It's being put in the mail as we speak, as we talk. And he goes, and listen, give me one of them kind that read English. I read that James guy once and I couldn't understand a word he said. Give me, you got an English one? Any of these guys ever talking English? So I got him a Henry Blackaby, NIV, Experiencing God Study Bible. And on the front of the Bible, I wrote these words. To my brother Richard, I love you. I'll see you later. I'll see you later. Well, then I had to go to Cambodia. Well, I didn't want to take my preaching Bibles. My notes are in there. I don't want to lose those. So I had to have a Bible. And I'm going through Acts. I got to have a study Bible. So I had to have the Bible. And I didn't know what to do. And the next day, my brother died. But before he died, my cousins, who were both Christians on Cape Cod, called me and they said, we went to see Richie yesterday before he died. And he said, give this Bible to Harry. Because if you don't, she'll throw it away. And they said, well, he'll be here next week. And he said, I won't be here next week. Give it to Harry and tell him these words, and they're very important. Tell him I said, I'll see you later. I'll see you later. And he died. And she had him cremated before we could get back up there. And she buried him in the backyard. But you know what? It never bothered me. She saved me a 3-hour drive up to see his dead body. I was pretty grateful. My sister was angry. I was grateful. You know why? He wasn't in there. He ejected. He wasn't there, folks. What do I want to go look at a dead guy with ashes? Why would I want to do that? He's gone. He's ejected. Someone said, hey, I hear you lost your brother. No, I know exactly where he is. He's not lost at all. I know where he is. He stepped through those gates, and the first thing he said was, golly, you were right. Golly, you were right. Don't you see? So I got that Bible in the mail, and I put it in my pack, and I left to go to Cambodia, and God used that time in Cambodia. And you haven't lived until you've sat at the feet of 22 Cambodian pastors who want to pick your brain about what you tell them the Bible has to say. And Ruffin was the main teacher, and he taught for 3 hours, and then I would teach for 2, and then Doug would teach for 45 minutes. And Doug was like kind of, you know, didn't want to do too much. And then Ruffin would teach the next day, and then I'd teach, and we split the teaching up. But Ruffin did a majority of the teaching. And I taught on the book of Acts, and Ruffin taught about how to pastor your church, and it was a great time. And these guys would sit, and they'd write everything down that we said to them and just sat at our feet. And we did it for 7 days. On Friday, we would be done. And then on Saturday, we would have a day off to just go down through Phnom Penh. And Phnom Penh, it would be like you taking 6 million people and putting them in Altus, Oklahoma. That's Phnom Penh. And you have big, big, huge buildings. And then you have, you know, people staying in a shack made of tin. And there'll be 4 families in there. And it's a very poor society. And God really showed me how blessed I was with all that I have. And then Friday came, and one of those Cambodian pastors came up to me, and he goes, he picked my Bible up, and he began to read it. And I said, can you read that? And he goes, up here, really good. Here, not so good. But up here, I can read it really good. And he goes, is this a good Bible? I said, oh, man, it's a really good Bible. And he says, is it very expensive? I said, well, that one particularly cost a life. That one cost a life. But you can buy one like that for about $30. He goes, $30? That's how much I make every month as a pastor. No, don't even go there. No, don't go. I'm not giving it away. Sorry. Strike me down dead. This is my brother's Bible. I'm sorry. I'm not giving that Bible away. And God very clearly that night, that day, looked at me, and here's what he spoke to my heart, Jeff. He said, Harry, as long as you're the hero of the story, I will be very limited in what I can do in and through you. But son, if you'll make me the hero of the story, You watch what I'll do with your life when you go back home. Now, who's going to be the hero of your story? Who's going to be the hero of your story? You or God? Because revival is not revival until you can come to this altar at night and say, God, you are the hero of the story. This is your church, and I'm going to quit my griping and get to training. Now, I want to share with you three very simple facts about Gideon tonight that you'll see. Because you're going to need to see tonight as we close this revival out. What's it going to take to be hero material? I mean, if God's going to be the hero of the story, what's it take to be hero material? Let me show it to you very quickly tonight. Number one, you want to be a hero for God? Gideon, number one, was a coward. You want to be a hero for God? All right, here's how you start. You got to be a coward. He was hiding in the wine press, fearful of everything that's happened. And God showed him with God what he was about to become. I want you to go in the strength you have because I am sending you. The power didn't come from Gideon. It came from God. The power comes from God. And he was a coward. And he lacked belief. And he lacked courage. Now, courage is not an absence of fear. It's saying no to fear and yes to God. Courage is not an absence of fear. It's saying no to fear and yes to God. And so Gideon was a Baptist, and so of course, after God said, go do this, he said, well, now, Lord, I've got to make sure I've heard from you now, so I'm going to put out my fleece. And now, God, if the fleece is wet and the ground is dry, I know you're speaking to me. So he goes out there and the ground's dry, and he goes and takes the fleece and wrings it out and fills up a bowl of water. Of course, he's a real Baptist. And he said, now, Lord, now that's good. That's good. Now that's good. But let's reverse it tomorrow. Let's let the ground be wet and the fleece be dry. How many times have you heard people say this? Well, I'm just kind of putting my fleece out to God. Well, that's no sign of spiritual maturity. Any person that says, well, I'm just putting my fleece out here to God, let me tell you what our fleece is. It's usually our lack of belief, our inability to see and hear from God. It's our inability to respond to God by faith and obedience. God already said, there's no need to put a fleece out. When you put a fleece out, what you're saying is, I'm not really sure I heard God. I'm not really sure I know how to hear from God. I'm not sure I'm ready to obey God. I'm not sure I want to walk by faith. There's nothing good about a fleece, people. Nothing good about that. A fleece isn't an act of faith. A fleece is an act of a person who's not willing to obey or can't hear. Don't you see? Cowards, aren't we all? Aren't we all in here tonight cowards? Let me define a coward. A coward's not a person who's afraid. We're just afraid to let God have total control of our lives. You want to know why we're cowards, people? Here's why. You're afraid to jump into the river of God and say, all right, any way you say go, I'll go. Young people, you want to know why some of you are cowards at school? Because you're afraid to say, okay, God, I'm a Christian. I want to be a Christian. I'm going to walk as a Christian. Here's my life. Take me any way you want. You want to know why Baptists are cowards today? We are afraid to walk with God by faith and say, here's my life. Here it is. Take me any way you want to go. Because if that was true, we wouldn't be getting all gripey because God takes us ways we don't want to go. Y'all getting this? So we're cowards. We're afraid to jump into the river of God and say, take me any way. Now, the second thing I want you to see about Gideon, not only was he a coward, but number two, he became a challenger. God says, okay, here's what I want you to do. Let's have a little test run here. I want you to go down and break down the altar of Baal. Break it down. And so he's a Baptist, so he goes at night. You're like you sneaking over to the Methodist church and burning it down, and you wait till it's nighttime. And then they come out, and what happens in the story is they come out to his house, and they're going to kill him. And his father says, wait a minute, what are you all bent out of shape for? If Baal is God, why don't you let Baal take care of him? And they said, all right, we're turning you over to Baal, and Baal's going to kill you. Right. Baal has no power any more than some of you in your carnality have any power. And in your carnality, I want you, there's more chances of a cow flying than you having the presence and the face of God when you're walking in your carnality. All you're going to have is his correction. It gets better. Watch this. Now he becomes a conqueror. And he comes to him, and here's what he says to him. He goes, go down there, and he says, I want you to go down and fight the Midianites. But you have too many men there. And he says, in order that Israel may not boast against me that her own strength has saved her, announce now to the people, anyone who trembles in fear may turn back. And 22,000 men left and 10,000 remain. So here's what he says. Okay, of all you Baptists, those of you who are chickens and simply are here to be involved, you can go home. And 22,000 of them left. 10,000 remain. He said, you still got too many men. In order that Israel may not boast that her own strength has saved her, now here's what I want you to do. I want you to go down to the water, and those that lap like a dog can stay. The rest got to go home. And there's only 300 men that lap like a dog. Let me show you what that means. They got down to the water, and this was a Sunday morning Baptist crowd, so they came in, and they're feed me people. And they come in, and they go to the water, and they go, feed me. And they go face first in the water, and they're there to feed as much as they want. But real heroes from God, they go down and they pick the water up and they lap like a dog. So they can see where God's working and they can join him. And they lap like a dog because they can see where the enemy's attacking and they can avoid it. But the person who's down there face first in the water, the carnal Christian, oh, he wants to be fed and fed and fed and fed. Because life is all about me, not about God. Not about God. And he goes down there with the 300 and he surrounds the camp. And you all know the story. You can go read it later. And they had a torch in one hand. And they had a trumpet in the other hand. And he says, when you hear me cry, a sword for the Lord and for Gideon. Take the trumpet, smash the jar, hold up the light, and blow the trumpet. See, they had to have the instrument of praise. They had to have the light of God. And when you're holding up the instrument of praise, and when you're holding up the instrument of God, there is no room for you to hold your sword. You can't hold your sword. All you can hold is the light of God and the instrument of praise. And they blew the trumpets, and the Midianites turned on each other, and they killed each other. And they never raised the sword. I want to tell you something about old Gideon. He couldn't hold up the sword of self-reliance. He couldn't hold up the sword of self-deliverance or self-sufficiency. He couldn't hold those up. I'll tell you something else. Three things Gideon overcame that day. Jeff, I want you to know he overcame his fears. No more would he be afraid. He overcame his foes. And he overcame his feelings. And when we overestimate our feelings, you will always underestimate your God, people. When you overestimate your feelings, you will always underestimate your God. Well, I don't know if God can do it. Well, I'll put my fleece on. No, you are underestimating God, and you're overestimating your own feelings. I don't have time to get into this, but let me share this with you. Gideon, at the end of his life, became a compromiser. He ended up a compromiser. Now, I think, in the life of Gideon, if he was here tonight and was going to close out the revival, I think Gideon would tell us three things. He would say this to you, First Baptist Church, because we've had a pretty good revival. Well, actually, we've had a pretty good meeting. We'll decide whether it's a revival or not. Come on. He'd give you three truths tonight. Here's the first one. After great victories, if you don't have a vision, you'll return to your past. First Baptist Church, without a vision, you have no future. Without a future, you will return to your past. You say, well, got to have a vision. Got to have a vision. So are we people of vision? No. We are people of revelation. Not a vision. The vision is following the revelation of God. God says, we follow. There's the vision. And the vision is Christ-likeness, God joy, mate joy, kids joy. There's the vision. And if you'll do those things, you'll be a church that cannot be explained by the world. You will be a church that God can trust His glory to, and folks will drive 1,000 miles to see God. Y'all getting this? There's more. Here's the second thing. He'd tell you this. Hey, Satan is subtle. If he has to wait 20 years to get you, he's got nothing but time. Don't forget timely self-examination. And the final thing he would teach you tonight, dependence on God can be turned around with just a little bit of forgetfulness and a little bit of compromise. That's what he would remind you tonight. And then I have a final story I want to share with you. And then you're going to have to decide at this altar tonight who's going to be the hero of your story. You or God. I want to be plain old honest with you like I've been all week. There's some of you in here, you're as carnal as all get out. You haven't been to this altar all week. And you're hindering revival. You need to come to God. Now, not everybody in this altar tonight is going to be carnal. Some of you are coming to this altar because God's dealing with your heart tonight and you want a closer look at God. But I'd like to close out with a story. As a matter of fact, when I found this story, it was so good I decided not to tell it in any other way but to read it. So I'm going to read this story to you, so please listen carefully. Edwin Thomas was a master of the stage. In the latter half of the 18th century, 1800s, he had few rivals. He was a premier Shakespearean actor. There are many who say Edwin Thomas is probably the greatest American Shakespearean actor that ever lived in the 1800s. It goes on to say he had two brothers who were both actors also. And in 1863, the three brothers played roles together in Julius Caesar. His brother John would play the role of Brutus, and John would play the role of an assassin later, because at Ford's Theater in April of 1865, Edwin Thomas Booth's brother, John Wilkes Booth, would snuff out the life of President Lincoln. The story goes on. Edwin was never the same. He left the stage because of his embarrassment, never to return, but a twist of fate changed all that. Several years later, Edwin was waiting for a train in New Jersey when a well-dressed young man, pressed by the crowd, fell off the platform onto an oncoming train. Without hesitation, Edwin, risking his own life, was able to reach his leg around a pole, reach down, and grab the young man from the oncoming train, and he saved his life. Weeks later, he would receive a letter, one that he would carry in his pocket till the day he died. The letter was from General Adam Boudreau, Chief Secretary to President Ulysses S. Grant. And the letter thanked him for saving the life of the son of a truly great American hero, because that day, Edwin Thomas Booth saved the life of Richard Todd Lincoln, the son of Abraham Lincoln. One brother tried to be the hero. And he ended up known as the greatest assassin of all times. One brother threw himself in the river of God and became a hero for God, and nobody knew about it. Now, which are you going to be? Now, who's going to be the hero of your story? Who's going to be the hero of First Baptist Church's story? Amen. Would you bow your heads with me tonight? And with our heads bowed, Brother Harry, God has been speaking to me all week. And I have not yet been to the altar this week, but I know I need to be. If that's you, would you simply hold your hand up high? Harry, I should be at this altar this week, and I know God's speaking to me. I got an area of my life that's not like Jesus Christ. Would you pray for me? Hold your hand up high. Anyone else? Be honest. Brother Harry, would you pray for me? I'm not sure I'm a Christian. If I died right now, I'm not sure I'd go to heaven. Would you please pray for me? Would you hold your hand up high? Harry, I've been struggling all week long with Christ-likeness. He's just not inside. When I look inside my heart, I just don't see Him. Harry, would you please pray for me? I'm not sure I'm a Christian. Would you hold your hand up high? Would you be honest tonight? Hold it up high till I see it. Harry, please pray for me. Would you hold your hand up high? Thank you. Anyone else? Thank you. Anyone else? Thank you. Now tonight, young people, those of you who prayed to receive Christ at our pizza time, I want you to come and stand with me. And those of you tonight who say, Brother Harry, I want Jesus Christ to be the hero of my story, and I need to give my heart to Jesus Christ, then I want you, along with these young people, to come and stand with us right now, with our heads bowed, with our eyes closed, as the piano plays very softly. Is God speaking to you? Do you mean business tonight with God? Some of you lifted your hand and said, I'm not sure Christ lives in my heart. Listen, you ought to run down this aisle because He cannot be the hero of your story until He becomes the hero of your heart. It's time for you to jump into the river of God and let Him take you any way He wants. So I'm inviting you to come and stand. And by standing, we're going to sit down and talk with you about what it truly means to be a Christian. That's right, you come. How about you, Mom? How about you, Dad? I'm going to need all our counselors now to please come forward. Maxie, will you make sure all our counselors are here? If you're a trained counselor, I need you to come. We're going to need about 9 or 10 of you. Please come quickly. If you are a trained counselor, we need you to come quickly. Come on, folks. Get up and come on. Young people, this fellow in the pink shirt, I want you to follow him. And we're going to take you out to another room because we want to talk to you for a minute.